Hi everybody, my name's Brett, I'm an addict. Well, this is all very weird. For all sorts of reasons. Number one, talking into this SM58. That's pretty strange because obviously, you know, it's not that meetings are generally recorded. So I guess kind of to be mindful of the fact that I can kind of very easily drop into entertainer mode. I used to work as a performer. So it's kind of quite a natural thing for me to do. So I'll try not to. What else do I need to say? I need to say kind of where I'm at the moment, because I found that what NA has given me is the chance, the ability to actually just kind of show you who I am, because that is the most frightening thing there is for me, is to reveal myself. My kind of whole way of being as I was growing up, as I was a child, as I was a teenager, was kind of, my training was just to kind of hide, to put up a mask and just kind of pretend that everything was okay, you know. And for me to come into a room full of people this size and kind of say that I'm feeling quite vulnerable at the moment, quite kind of fragile, feels a very risky thing to do. But I've been around long enough to know that people won't be judging me off for saying this. People will be going kind of, yeah, I know that. I've been there. I know how that feels. And I should probably, because I've got kind of a good chunk of time to be able to share with you this evening, I'll get back to that, I'm sure. But all I need to do is actually say that's how I'm feeling right now. I'm kind of feeling a lot of less than. Excuse me. And I remember when I was first kind of given that phrase at a treatment centre, when I first got into recovery, people started talking about feeling less than. And I just, it didn't compute. I didn't understand it. I had no conception at all of feeling less than, because, I always felt better than, you know. I always felt superior to everybody. If I thought you were anywhere near kind of an equal, or even, dare I dread the thought, superior to me in any kind of shape or form, I would either befriend you and make sure you were in my camp, or I'd just fuck you off, you know. But generally, I just thought everybody was kind of just a little bit below me, and I was just so cool, you know. I mean, and that was my ego driving me along and trying to make me feel okay, you know. And that's why I say it's a bit weird sitting here talking into a microphone, because I know my ego can switch in and make me kind of say the things that I think you'll want to hear, because I want you to like me. I want you to think I'm okay, because if you think I'm okay, then maybe I am okay, because I don't think I am. At bottom, there's a big, big part of me that doesn't think that I'm okay, that I'm enough. That's hard to live with. I'm sure you know that already, though. So less than. I first heard that phrase 12 and a half years ago, I guess, something like that. I'll tell you a little bit about kind of what my life was like, how I came to be in need of what's on offer in these rooms. And believe me, I do need it. I still need it today. I need everything that's kind of on offer here. And sometimes I'm good at taking what's offered to me, and sometimes I just refuse it, and I think I know best. I go back to that thinking, I'm superior to you all. I know the answers, you know. And a lot of that is just because that's the way I was kind of brought up. That's the way I learned to deal with life, because life can be quite difficult, can be quite painful. It can seem very confusing, and a lot of the time, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't have kind of the instruction list in front of me, you know. Not that if I did have the instruction manual, I'd be likely to follow it, because the last thing I do when I get a new mobile phone is to look at the instruction book and, you know, I'll press every button available and then throw it at the wall because it doesn't work before I'll look into the manual, you know. I actually had a friend who worked on a computer help desk, and he would say to people, RTFM, when they phoned up and said, I can't do this, I don't know how to do this, you know. He'd say it under his breath, because if he actually said it and they asked what it meant, RTFM, he'd get the sack, because it stood for read the fucking manual, you know. And sometimes I have to say that to myself, you know. Read the manual, here it is. I got clean in 1994. after using, well, nearly 30 years, pretty much 30 years, I had, you know, my first drink, I think, when I was about 13. I came from a family that was, you know, it was working class with middle class pretensions, and, you know, which they finally achieved when my dad got to be made managing director of the company he worked for since he was a tea boy. You know, when he was a little, when he first left school, he started as a tea boy there, and he worked and grafted his way up to that position, you know. And that's what made him feel okay about himself, you know. That was his idea of taking care of his family, you know. But I never saw him. He had no, very little part in my life other than as a threat of wait till your dad gets home, you know. So I learned at an early age, you know, how to kind of behave, how to put that mask up, and, you know, yeah, I'm a really good boy. Yes, I've done my homework. Yes, I'm a good boy. But as soon as I was out the door, I was into any kind of mischief that was possible. You know, as a child, I used to love a dare. You know, anybody would dare me to climb that tree. There's the mark. We can see it from here of the last person who got that high. You know, see if you can beat it. And I'd try it, you know. And I fell out of a good few fucking trees, and I tell you that. I've broken my arms about 4 times in falling off of things because of a dare, you know. What's that about? That's about getting your approval, isn't it? That's about me wanting to kind of be accepted, to be part of, you know. And it's one of the, you know, I was going to say recovery is full of paradoxes. Recovery is life to me. Life today I live in recovery, and that's what I do. But it is full of paradoxes, and you know, and that paradox of kind of wanting to belong to something in one shape or form, but actually, you know, the last thing I want to do is to be part of something, you know. I want to just isolate and just kind of keep you at a distance. But at the same time, I'm desperate for you to come forward and go, hi, Brett, how are you doing? You know. And, you know, I don't understand that. I don't know why it is like that for me, but that's how it is, you know. That's how it was from kind of day one, you know. I didn't know how to deal with life. I didn't have the instruction book. Nobody gave me much guidance. So I just did the best I could. And the best I could was to pretend, you know. And it was difficult. It was painful, you know. It's hard kind of when you think, you know, as a little child, you've got to deal with life yourself. You know, you've got to sort it out. You've got nowhere to go to kind of go, I don't know what to do. I need some help here. That just didn't happen, you know. I don't know, help was not a phrase that ever kind of came into my head, you know. I'd never seen anybody do it. So I thought I had to do it all on my own, and you know, and I tried valiantly, you know. And I'm not a stupid person, you know. I'm quite capable, and I'm gifted, just like every single one of you in this room is. You know, I know you are. I know you are. I know that human beings are beautiful. You know, they really are, and I believe that fundamentally human beings are good. You know, and given the chance, they shine. You know, but a lot of us didn't have that chance. You know. And that's one of the most wonderful things I see in recovery is when I come into a room like this and I just see people shining, you know, and it really lifts me up, you know. It can also fuck me off immensely when I feel like I'm really dull and not shining at all, you know, because I'm jealous and I'm weak and I'm judgmental and I'm intolerant, and when I'm frightened, all those things come out in me, you know. But I'm jumping forward to how I am now, aren't I? I'm trying to keep this in some sort of semblance of order. So I'm starting with, you know, how it was before drugs came into the picture, you know. It was hard, and I found it difficult, you know. I didn't know it at the time. I just thought that's the way it was, you know. This is what you did, you know. But as soon as I found that one little magic ingredient that changed that feeling of being a little bit scared, a little bit unsure, a little bit not knowing, a little bit, ooh, what's happening? When I found something that changed that into, I don't give a fuck, I can do what the hell, who cares, you know? It was magical. It was like kind of discovering Walt Disney or something. It really was, you know? And I remember so well the kind of, you know, that first drink of vodka and orange. It wasn't even, you know, fresh orange juice. It was that dreadful orange cordial, you know, and it was a filthy, horrible drink, and I had to kind of choke it down because at 13, I'd never tasted alcohol, and it's a filthy stuff, you know. It really tastes disgusting, but still, I've kind of, you know, the first mouthful just did something, and I forced it down, you know, and I just, you know, and I actually kind of, I didn't kind of immediately run out and start buying cans of special brew, of course not. But I just knew that this was, there was something here, you know. There was something going on here. This did something to me and I liked it, you know. And the next opportunity I had of kind of trying something else, a little bit different, you know, I went for it, you know. And at school, the kind of, you know, the standard progression, somebody offered me a joint and I kind of smoked it and I pretended I was really stoned, but I didn't know what was happening. And I just kind of watched what everybody else was doing and going, oh, yeah, man, you know. I can't actually remember having any effect at all. In fact, I'm sure the bloke had given me a really kind of a bag of something he just scraped off the playing field. But that doesn't mean. I pretended that it just made me stoned, you know, but I liked the idea of it. I really liked the idea of doing something, you know, a little bit naughty, a little bit daring, a little bit pushing the boundaries, you know. I liked that kind of rebel stance. I loved it from day one. I love being kind of just different and special and, you know, that special and different thing we hear about. And the next thing I kind of was offered was a white paper bag full of blue pills, you know, which surprisingly were called blues, you know. And for those of you who don't know what they are, it's an amphetamine, you know. And I just remember this grinning idiot with eyes out of his head, you know, like that, you know. And I just took a handful, you know, and kind of swallowed them down. And I think this was when I was 15, and I was on a Kent coast town, which is what you did when you were kind of a bit of a naughty teenager. You know, you went for a trip down the seaside and created a bit of mayhem. And when somebody gave me this, you know, and then, you know, 15 minutes, well, what was the point of that? You know, what are they? They did 20 minutes. This is where you cut. Bang. You know, I was gone. You know it, don't you? You know it. That moment that the brain switches and you're gone and you're there and you're in the zone and nothing can touch you. Nothing can touch you. I could do anything. I could blag my way back on the train because I didn't have a ticket, because when the inspector came up and said, "Where's your ticket?" I said, "I don't have one." And then I talked him to death. I just talked and talked and said, "Well, what do you do? What happens when you don't have a ticket?" You know, and I was off, and the guy just kind of was looking at me, and in the end, he just backed away. He said, "It doesn't matter, mate. It doesn't matter." He just backed off, and I went, "Oh, no, come back, you know. I can smile at it now, but, you know, then I get home, you know, and Sunday night I try to go to bed, I try to go to sleep, and I'm going, oh, man, and that was it. And then the come down starts, you know, and that my first experience of kind of coming down off that first real drug experience was absolutely horrific. You know, I was in this kind of my little bedroom in my parents' house, just kind of sitting on the bed, you know, moving from that place of being desperately wanting someone to talk to, because I've got to talk to someone. Oh, I haven't spilt your tea again. That's good. To that place of going, I want to die. I want to kill myself. Why do I feel this way? I didn't understand it. The bloke with the bulging eyes and the bag of blues didn't say, by the way, when you come down off these, you're going to feel so shit you won't want to. I didn't know what was happening to me, you know. It kind of went on for a couple of days. I felt so horribly depressed, and you know that, you know, maybe you've experienced it. But and this is the killer, you know, next weekend. I didn't go, oh, no, take them away. That was horrible. I'm not doing that again. It was, can I buy the bag? I was off and running. I loved it. I loved it. It was a career for me. And my career move was to move on to the next drug up the career ladder, you know. And I'm going to have such a crick in my neck, you know, I'm leaning over there. I want to sit back here and shout at you, but I've got to make a good recording because I'm going to take it home and edit it and cut out the good bits and probably splice in a couple of shares off of somebody else's tape, you know. Do a remix. Boo-hoo. YouTube. Anybody got a video camera? Oh, sorry, I'm getting silly here. I loved the whole life. You know, this was in the 60s. You know, the 60s was a, you know, all that nonsense about you had to be there to experience it, and if you do remember it, you weren't there, or whatever other rubbish you hear about. It doesn't matter. You know, drugs were about, and then where they were, I went, and when I went there, I took them. You know, and it didn't matter what it was. It didn't matter. It really didn't matter. I had my favourites, and I quickly found it, and it was the bogeyman of the drug world, you know. And when I arrived at taking kind of that particular drug intravenously, I really felt I'd become the managing director. You know, I felt I'd arrived. It really did. You know, I was so proud, and I kind of wore it like a badge. And I found out all chemists that sold the kit I needed. I'd walk around with a carrier bag, which would kind of fall open in front of people, and I kind of loved their kind of horror when they saw a kind of a huge carrier bag chock-a-block with syringes, you know. I loved all that kind of shock value. I loved all that kind of, I'm a naughty boy, I'm tougher than you are, you know. And I controlled my drug use. Of course I controlled my drug use, didn't I just? Do you know what? I never for one moment thought that I wasn't in control of my drug use. 30 years later, when I was in a kind of a council flat in Clapham, where a friend who was in, you know, not far off as mad a state as I was, had given me a bit of floor space, and I had nothing, and I'd lost everything, and all the things you've heard that happened to people had happened to me, I still thought I was controlling my drug use. I still thought I was in charge. I didn't know I wanted a day clean. I heard somebody say that, and it really resonated with me. Because I wasn't one of those people, you know, who kind of kept thinking, I've got to stop this. The only time I ever thought I've got to stop doing this was I've got to stop using this particular drug, because if I take a bit of a break from it, you know, I know when I come back to it, it will be more effective, and then I'll get high the way I want to get high, because it's not the same as it used to be, you know. When I first started using drugs, the Chinese were bringing in some good stuff, you know, and now you get this brown stuff, you've got to mix shit with it, you know, and the deals are small, and I'm sure they're all cutting, you know, and all that nonsense, and it was just me, because I needed more and more drugs to penetrate the bigger and bigger load of pain that I was piling onto me, you know, because, you know, all those years I was using drugs, I thought I was in charge, I thought I was in control, I thought I had the choice, I thought I was choosing to do what I was doing, you know. And the reality wasn't. The reality that I was being driven by this need to have drugs, because to live life without some sort of drug in my system was just something I couldn't contemplate. I just could not deal with it. It was just, you know, it was like kind of saying you're going to have to stop using oxygen. It was really kind of so much part of who I was and what I did and how I dealt with life that, there, you know, the thought of actually not doing it was just kind of, it was beyond being thought. It just had never, ever, ever occurred to me. And when I did finally get into a place where somebody kind of said to me, Brett, what's on offer here is total abstinence. You know, it was just, I couldn't understand. I just said, okay, yeah, but I can't have a drink. And, you know, no, Brett, total abstinence, anything. Look at your history. Look at what you did. Look at all those times where you tried to stop using one particular drug. You're using another one. There was always something there, you know. And it took a long time for me to kind of break through that denial, you know. But that's kind of, that's step one. That was step one for me, you know, understanding that. And it was something that took a long time for me to really kind of take on board. But amongst that that kind of drug-using career, you know, I was going to say some success, and I suppose I did, you know, because, you know, like I was saying earlier, I do really believe that we're such fantastically talented and kind of gifted people, you know, and I think addicts really do have something special above and beyond, you know, that kind of natural goodness that I do believe that people has. I think addicts have a little dose extra of it, and maybe the downside of that is it's hard to cope with. It's hard to cope with being kind of that wonderful and that talented and that gifted, you know. And that's what I find it anyway. You know, I believe in myself, but it's kind of such a fragile belief. You know, it doesn't take much to knock it, you know. And when I can, you know, I can tumble from those heights of thinking, you know, I'm really, I can do anything. And then something knocks me and I tumble down to those depths where I think I can't do anything. You know, it's all hopeless. I give up, you know. And that was me. That was me, you know. That person would, you know, kind of go from being, oh, yeah, I'm going to do the blah, and then suddenly I'd fall, you know, and I wouldn't do anything. But in amongst that, you know, I kind of had a wife and I had two children. I had a home, you know, really nice home, and I had a career at which I was kind of quite successful. And it was a very glamorous career. It was kind of in the film industry, and you know, I got paid lots of money to travel to kind of exotic places and sort of film very strange, peculiar things of whatever nature. And it just felt like such a kind of a fantastic thing to be doing that I didn't really understand that half the time I was invited along and on these shoots and flown to these exotic places was because I was selling them cocaine, you know. I was the one who kind of brought along that stuff. And I sought out people who were kind of like me. I went into places where I could, and this is what I didn't understand. This is why, this is what I didn't understand was the drugs were controlling me. I thought I was in control. I thought I'd choose to work with those particular people because they're kind of wild. They're rock and roll. I like them. But they were also wild and rock and roll and using drugs, you know. That's why I went there. I didn't go in with the kind of the people, the units that were working and kind of, you know, fairly normal. I chose to go with them. And that was because the drugs were saying, you go there and you'll be able to use, you know. And I had success in that, you know. I did well and I, you know, and for a while my life kind of looked really, you know, if I could have stepped outside and looked at it, it looked like I was having a whale of a time. It looked like I was having a ball, you know. I was kind of, I had the flash cars and all the kind of stuff. I had money to burn and I had sort of, you know, all the drugs I could possibly kind of want. And yet I still felt scared. I still felt as if I was a fraud. I always felt as if somebody was going to come along and kind of just go, we know about you, Brett. It's, you know, come with us. That's, and that was just, you know, that was so frightening to be in that place. Just that kind of sense of just, I'm going to get found out at any moment, you know. That the only way I knew of kind of running from those feelings was to take more drugs. Because I can't, you know, I found dealing with life and life's feelings, as I said, you know, from a little child, just that kind of, I didn't know it was okay to just feel a way that I felt. I thought I had to do something to change it, you know, and drink and drugs were the perfect way for me to kind of manage my life, you know. And a lot of my using was about kind of just medicating and just kind of, if I feel good, I think I'll use a bit more because then I'll feel even better. If I feel bad, oh, I better go and use because then I'll feel okay again, you know. And it just went on this endless cycle. And it, when do I stop? 8:30? A bit before, I better speed it up a bit, really. Because I was going to talk you all through the steps and tell you how to do them, because, you know, poor, do I know. I am kidding. I haven't a clue, really. All I know is I keep coming here. But all of that stuff, you know, all that success and all that kind of using manageably, as we kind of hear it called in NA, it fell apart. You know, it took a long time for it to fall apart for me because I'm very obstinate, very stubborn, and I just kind of gritted my teeth and kept going with my life. You know, no matter how bad it got. And when my wife left me, when the children got taken away, when they came and repossessed the home I had. When I kind of spiraled down to that point where I was relying on somebody to just give me a bit of floor space in their flat in Clapham, you know. And it was a pretty mad kind of, it was not a good place to be. I still kept going with that kind of endless, I'm just going to hang on to the drugs. No, the kids can go, that's all right. But don't, I'll hang on to the drugs, you know. And everything was taken away until it was just me and the drugs, and the drugs didn't work. And that was the place that I had to come to that we call a rock bottom. If the drugs had continued to work, and by working I mean they'd stopped me feeling the way I felt, I would have kept taking them. It's not that I didn't kind of gouch out. It's not that I didn't kind of throw up. It's not that I didn't reel around and fall over if I drank so much. All those kind of physical things were going on, but it didn't penetrate that pain, that sense of how did I get here? How did I become a man whose two children kind of have been taken away from him? The two people I love most in the world, you know, the two people I would die for. How come they're not in my life? You know, how did I get to this point? How did that happen? And you know what? The worst thing about that rock bottom was just being that hopelessness, you know. And I thought it was going to be like that forever. You know, I did not know that it could be different. I'd been to an NA meeting in the mid-80s, but I didn't know it was an NA meeting. You know, it was somewhere I was told to go by a clinic I was being kind of medicated by, and it was kind of a suggestion that I went to this meeting, and basically if I didn't go, they cut me off. So I went along, and I didn't know what it was, and I just kind of, I actually seem to recall, and it might be my false memory, but I'm pretty sure I was sitting there clutching a bottle of Grolsch all through the meeting. I don't know whether, I remember there being beanbags, candles, and a lot of women, you know, and I was pretty scary. I looked pretty fucking scary, you know. You know, and I was sitting there clutching this bottle of Grolsch and kind of nobody came to talk to me. And I'm surprised, you know. That's the vaguest memory I have of being in an NA meeting in the 80s. And, you know, I went along because I was told to, but it meant nothing to me. I remember nothing of it, you know. But I eventually got to that place where I was teachable, where I was open to hear what was on offer in a room like this, you know. And as I say, it took me a long time. It took all those years, but it took what it took, you know, and it took me to get to that point where the drugs didn't work anymore and I couldn't take feeling hopeless like this. I couldn't deal with another day where I would just come to and go, oh, how am I going to do this? You know, it's a painful, painful place. And then, you know, you've been there. You know what it's like. You've had your own version of it. And that kind of just being in that despair of just not thinking it can be different. This is the way it's going to be until I die, you know. Man, I'm so glad I'm not there anymore. You know, even on the darkest, darkest kind of times, you know, that I've had in recovery, the fact that I am not there is something I can kind of, I can remind myself, or I can be reminded by going to a meeting. I'm not there. I'm in here and I have a chance, you know. The first meeting I went to of my own volition, of my own choice, was the Brixton meeting on Sunday. And what happened in that meeting is probably the most crucial thing that ever happened to me in my entire life. And it's something I always remember, and it's something I try to do myself. And it's something I know I've heard a lot of people, they've had a similar experience. And it was a very simple something, and I can't describe it in words that can give it the weight I feel it deserves, because it saved my. It means I'm sitting here today, because I'd be dead if it. I mean, I know that my health was such that I would not have survived the 13 years I have survived. And it was very simple. I went to that meeting, and I had much the same attitude that I had when I went to that meeting 86. I didn't have the bottle of Grolsch, by the way. I don't think I could afford it, but I'd come out of a treatment facility. I'd been clean kind of, you know, I don't know, 12 weeks, I think, something like that. I come home, and there was, you know, it was a weekend, and I tried to get some money. I tried to get my hands on some money so, you know, so I could have some money. Then I'd feel all right, you know. And that, to me, that meant if I had money, I would have gone to the off-license. And if I'd gone to the off-license, I would have the wheel, you know. You know what would have happened. And, you know, I'd had some very weird experiences of trying to get some money and it just not being possible, you know. I'd gone to the post office because I had some 20 quid in a post office account. And just as I got, you know, about 10 feet away from the door, the guy turned the sign round, closed, you know, and I banged on the door with my little post office book going, please, please let me in. And he kind of went, no, you can't. And I suddenly, well, you know, you can imagine what I said to him. But I then suddenly remembered, I've got a building society. And I'm sure there's a bit of money in that. And I ran down to the building society, and the same thing happened, except for they shut at 2 o'clock, whereas the post office shut at one. You know, so I got to the door, just again, it was shutting. You know, just they turned the thing round, they were locking the door, and they wouldn't let me in. You know, and I was so furious. You know, but I ended up on Sunday with no money and nothing to do. You know, and in hindsight, I really do believe that that was God helping me. I really do believe that that was my higher power going, Brett, I'm not going to let you have that money because I know what you're going to do with it, you know. And maybe that's just me romancing the story, but it's, you know, that's what I believe. So on Sunday, lonely, frightened, terrified, didn't know what to do, but knew that there was an NA meeting on that evening, and I'd been to NA meetings in the treatment facility. Didn't understand a word of what was going on because it was down in Cornwall or somewhere like that. And I couldn't understand the accents, and they were talking about tractors and driving down the off-lines in the tractor. And I thought, what the fuck has that got to do with me? You know, I was very close-minded. But I was so frightened and I so didn't know what to do with myself that I went to this meeting. And I sat there with that same attitude of don't come near me. You know, I turned up kind of 3 minutes late to the starting time. So, you know, I knew that nobody would have the chance to talk to me. And at the end, I was just kind of, you know, waiting for that second of breaking hands and the meeting's over. And I had my kind of, my running spikes on, and I had my feet placed on those chocks, and I was in position to make for that door, you know. And I took off for that door like at a breakneck speed, head down, don't look at it, no eye contact. And as I got to the door, there was this monster of a man kind of leaning against it, and he kind of watched me coming toward him. And as I went to squeeze past him, he kind of shot his hand out like this, and he stopped me dead, because he was a big fucker. And he shook his hand, and I shook hands, and he said, no, my name's Kim, what's yours? And I had to say something to, you know. And I just told him my name, and he said, are you new? And I said, yeah. And he talked to me for about 2 minutes. I don't remember what he said. Doesn't matter. He didn't say anything. He didn't give me the secrets of the kingdom. He didn't give me the magic wand. Here, off you go. Oh, blimey, that threw me. But what he did, he gave me some love. He gave me 2 minutes worth of love that just melted my heart. It absolutely kind of punched straight through that veneer of I'm okay, fuck off, leave me alone, keep away from me, don't come, you know. He went straight through it and he just touched me, right in that really soft, vulnerable part inside of me that was frightened and lonely and desperate and wanted someone to love him. And I'll never, ever forget that, you know. It makes me want to cry right now, but I don't do that. And I walked away and I took that kind of feeling home with me, and it translated into a bit of hope that maybe it could be different. That maybe what was on offer in this room was nothing more and nothing less than love. Nothing more and nothing less. And it's here for every one of us, you know. And that's what my high power is, you know. Maybe it's because I'm a bit of a Beatles fan, and, you know, all you need is love. And it's the truth. God is love. That's what I believe, you know. I believe that there's an energy in this universe that is beyond my understanding. I don't need to understand it. The common word for it is God. So that works for me. And I believe that when I'm connected to that power, I can deal with anything. I can be anything. I can be that person that shines that I talked about. When I lose contact with it, when I lose my faith, when I lose my trust, I go into the negative person who's frightened and doesn't think he can do anything. And I trap myself and I spiral into being frozen. And I have to come back here. And I have to hear again that there's love in this room. And that will fix me. It will fix me. And I use that word advisedly. Because every single action I did in those 30 years of using, I was trying to fix myself. And I thought on occasions that it worked, you know. On occasions, maybe it did. But that was my best friend, you know. That packet, that bottle, was my best friend. but it turned around and betrayed me. What's on offer here has never ever betrayed me. What's on offer here is just so magical, it's so beyond description that, you know, I just kind of flounder around in the dark trying to kind of tell people what it's like when they don't know. And if there's anybody here who's kind of, who doesn't know because they're new to it, or because they've been here and they're not, they, it hasn't worked for them yet, you know, just hang on to that kind of simple phrase that I heard day one, keep coming back. That's what I heard, and it didn't seem like anything to me. It didn't seem like any kind of help or advice or direction. It felt a very, very inadequate solution to the Brett's problems, you know, which were so big, you know. You don't know how bad it is for me. How dare you say keep coming back? You know, that was me, but I did. I did keep coming back, you know. So if you're one of those people, God, I'm going to bring this in on time if it kills me. If you're one of those people who's struggling and it hasn't touched you yet, just keep coming back and it will. There's love in this room. It'll touch you, it'll heal you, and it'll show you how to live. Keep coming back.